From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On September 6, Israel seems to have launched an airstrike at a target in northern Syria. If you crave details, join the crowd.
I wonder if you could tell us what the target was, whether you supported this bombing raid, and what do you think it does to change the dynamic in an already hot region?
I'm not going to comment on the matter. Would you like another question?
Did you support it?
I'm not going to comment on the matter.
The governments of Syria and Israel were equally forthcoming, and with all the other sources on the story anonymous, it's impossible to tell actual information from politically motivated speculation. Some say the strike hit weapons bound for Hezbollah. Others say it was a dry run for an attack on Iran. And others that it hit a nuclear site set up with the help of North Korea, with whom America has just forged an anti-nuke agreement. Washington Post foreign editor Keith Richburg has seen speculation swirl, while the facts remain just out of reach.
It's been a greatly kept secret because normally the Israelis are among the most talkative officials we speak with covering the world. But on this case, they've been incredibly tight-lipped. There have been a lot of things coming unofficially out of opposition figures like Bibi Netanyahu, but nothing really official. On the other hand, there's been so much sort of unofficially leaking out from John Bolton, from think tankers, from U.S. officials off the record, that we seem to be getting a good outline of precisely what this is, but we don't know if it's accurate or not. It's being reported that this was nuclear material.
It's being speculated that it's nuclear material. I guess my question is the Post reporting sourced beyond those who are generally hostile to Syria or, like John Bolton, strongly opposed the deal with North Korea? I mean, in other words, are there any sources on this story that don't have a stake?
Well, that's the problem. And none of these sources are what you'd call sort of A, official sources, and B, unbiased sources. And so until we get anything official, either from the U.S. administration or from the Israelis, we simply don't know. And I might add, even the Syrians are being incredibly tight-lipped. Even their response or their criticism to this obvious violation of their airspace and bombing of their territory was incredibly muted.
Now, the Wall Street Journal's news pages have stayed pretty much away from this story, and even the New York Times has been very circumspect about the speculated scenarios. But if you read Glenn Kessler's stories, among all the speculations, the Post's pieces always put the nuclear one right at the top.
Well, that's because Glenn's got pretty good sources at the State Department telling him that this is indeed what the Israelis are saying they bombed. Now, I think he's been cautious to call it suspected nuclear components or nuclear material because the Israelis are saying they had intelligence saying that this was there, and so they bombed it. The Americans are telling our reporters that, yes, this is what the Israelis said without actually verifying it themselves.
When the Washington Post report says that information is said to come primarily from Israel, including dramatic satellite imagery, and you have somebody like John Pike of globalsecurity.org who, if nothing else, knows his satellite imagery, says that there wouldn't be anything dramatic at this stage in a nuclear program, you have to wonder, do you worry that you may be ahead of this story?
I'm always cautious on any story involving unnamed sources, and that's what you've got here. I think we have to be a little bit cautious here. You know, he said there wouldn't be dramatic. We described it as dramatic. Well, that depends on what your definition of dramatic is. We can only say what people are saying to us. And certainly, I think people have to read anything with a note of caution. We know how accurate those same unnamed officials have been in the past. So obviously, we're trying a really tough balancing act here to try to reveal as much information as we know, or at least what people are saying, without ourselves saying we, the Washington Post, have verified this.
I'm a great admirer of Glenn Kessler's work. In this case, though, despite the qualifications, I can't help but feel that the Washington Post has already made up its mind about this story. It just can't tell us how it knows.
You'll have to talk to Glenn Kessler on that. You know, a lot of people out there just want to replay what happened before the lead up to the Iraq War. So they're suspicious of anything that's based on intelligence sources that might have a motive. And that's understandably so. But as I said, you know, when you've got a veteran reporter who's reporting something based on sources, you know, you have to go with what your reporters are saying. There are editors here, and these things do get questioned and vetted back here in the newsroom. We can't go too much into our own process back here, but we're dealing with this murky world of intelligence. You're always going to be getting things from officials on either side.
Keith, thank you very much.
Okay, no problem.
Keith Richburg is the foreign editor of The Washington Post. Another story journalists are reporting from a distance is unrest in Burma. Burma is closed to foreign reporters, and as Buddhist monks take to the street to protest nearly 20 years of military rule, the Post, like many other news outlets, have based reporters in Thailand to catch whatever news slips past the filtered cell phones, emails, and blogs. Sein Nguyen is a Burmese exile and the managing editor of the Mizima News, a web-based news service in Bangkok. His site has seen an explosion in users from the exile community, eager for information and images of the pro-democracy demonstrations back home.
So they want to know. They're so excited. They think something big will happen in near future.
Do you have any way to check the accuracy of what you're reporting?
Yeah. When I get information from an email, I have to check with the telephone to call. Then I check with the neighbors so that I can verify.
That's amazing. So you get a report from somebody. You have to call around the area to make sure that report is true. That must be enormously difficult.
Sure. Very, very difficult. Sometimes we have to dial more than 20 numbers, you know, like a random call. And I have to check in yellow pages and look for the phone number to the nearest place of the demonstration so that I can ask, have you seen this? Some people don't know, or some people, they cannot answer clearly. So it is very, very hard, but we have to do it. We don't have choice. We don't have other options. We have to do.
You're an exiled Burmese journalist. Do you feel that sense of hope, or are you more skeptical?
I'm a Burmese, and whatever I live in, and my mind, I stay inside Burma.
No matter where you live in your mind, you're always in Burma. How long since you've really been in Burma?
I left Burma 7 years ago.
Do you expect you'll be going back soon?
I hope so. Every night, I think I will go back tomorrow. I will have a chance to go tomorrow.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, Mr. Nguyen. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Sein Nguyen is the managing editor of Mizima News.
Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was the most visible of the dignitaries in Manhattan this week to attend the United Nations General Assembly. He was invited to speak at Columbia University, where he was called a petty dictator by Columbia President Lee Bollinger. He was denied a visit to Ground Zero, and he was defiant at the UN. All in a few days' work for the Iranian president, who, with his signature jackets, ubiquitous grin, and fiery rhetoric, worked the media at every available podium. Dr. Edward Luck directs the Center on International Organization at Columbia University, and he explains that Ahmadinejad is not the first to turn his UN address into a theatrical production.
One thinks back, obviously, of Khrushchev banging his shoe on the podium when he didn't like what he was hearing. Several times Castro has been there. Arafat came with both a hat and a holster. Debate as to whether he actually had a pistol in that holster or not. Che Guevara. We've had Daniel Ortega. We've had a lot of quite fiery characters. And, of course, last year we had Hugo Chavez with his comments about the place smelling like the devil had just been there since Bush had just spoken.
El diablo está en casa, pues. Ayer vino el diablo aquí.
The UN is like the flame before the moth. I mean, it's irresistible. Where else do you get 191 other member states lined up to listen to you? And you can really, you know, if you want to talk about this issue, that issue, the other issues, there's no rebuttal. No one's going to question what you said. And it looks like you're the equal of any other leader. You pay your dues. You can go there and say what you want to say.
Ahmadinejad seemed to genuinely relish his opportunity. He was quite animated, and even when getting laughed at and booed, he maintained his equanimity. Is the history of demagogues at the UN one of equivalent showmanship?
I think in some ways, they know that it may not be a completely friendly forum, but I think they want to prove that they're on the same level as their critics. And who knows, you know, if they're in societies in which they're not getting very straight feedback from the public or from the media or others because of a lack of freedom, they may actually think that, in fact, whatever they have to say is brilliant or very persuasive or whatever, and they may not quite understand.
There are obviously risks attendant to speaking at the UN in confrontational ways. You can become an object of ridicule. You can become a kind of caricature of tyranny, the way Khrushchev did. And in the case of Chavez, you can actually undercut your clout within the United Nations General Assembly itself. But to your way of thinking, are these presentations really for international consumption so much as they are for a domestic audience?
Certainly when American presidents go to the UN, they tend to be aiming first and foremost at a domestic audience. And I think it's true for many of these groups as well. And you saw the Iranian response to Ahmadinejad and the way he was treated, particularly at Columbia. But I think there was also an international audience of trying to say that, you know, he's totally innocent and these charges about trying to acquire nuclear weapons or human rights violations that others are very much trumped up, that this, in fact, is a Western assault on Islamic values. In some ways, the way he was treated at Columbia sort of fed into that.
Ahmadinejad's visit was pretty much a prolonged media circus. Most of the coverage that I read has been, well, skeptical, to say the least, and in some cases actually mocking. But was he in a no-lose situation with respect to the media? I mean, if they're sympathetic to him or respectful, he gains standing. And if they're harsh on him, he gets to go back and say, you see, the conspiracy is alive and well.
Well, you know, I think in essence, if he gets attention, he's won the game. In that sense, I think you're right. It's a no-lose situation. When he loses is if no one pays attention.
But I'm wondering what the media are to do in a case like this. Yes, he's a demagogue, and to the extent that you give him coverage, you're only serving his purposes. But on the other hand, can he be ignored?
I think he can be minimized. You know, I mean, it is striking that same day there was a summit conference at the UN on climate change. Got very little media attention. You know, he comes up at Columbia and then he says some stupid things, which are probably quite predictable. It gets enormous press coverage. I mean, the press has a choice. Why do they all have to cover the same story and basically saying more or less the same thing? You know, I hope there will be some reflection about why do we give center stage to these people.
Ed, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Edward Luck directs the Center on International Organization at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Remember when Nixon's reputation was rehabilitated? Well, now it's nuclear power's turn. On Monday, an electric company called NRG Energy filed an application to build two new nuclear reactors in Texas, the nation's first since 1979. That is, since Three Mile Island's partial meltdown in Pennsylvania, which occurred a mere 12 days after a movie was released about a fictional meltdown in California. The China Syndrome, starring Jane Fonda, combined with real-life Three Mile Island, formed what Freakonomics co-author Stephen Dubner calls a solar eclipse of bad publicity.
What did he say to you, Mr. Spindler?
He said he thought this plant ought to be shut down.
And you agree with that? Should it be shut down?
Come
whose
on,
place is
go.
It?
No, come on.
State police were notified this morning of a general emergency at Unit 2 of Three Mile Island.
They detected a small amount of radioactive iodine on the ground. It may show up in the milk.
The situation is more complex than the company first led us to believe.
After that, plus all the heat already generated by the anti-nuke movement, the nuclear power industry melted down.
It kind of gave everybody who was on the fence thinking, geez, I don't know if it's safe. I don't know if it's the right thing. Kind of gave all of those people a push to say, you know what, I think now that it's not. And the plans that were on the drawing board for a whole lot of nuclear power plants were basically abandoned. Financing dried up.
It wasn't supposed to go down that way. President Eisenhower wanted to use the power of the atom for good.
It is not enough to take this weapon out of the hands of the soldiers. It must be put into the hands of those who will know how to strip its military casing and adapt it to the arts of peace.
From the very beginning of our industry, there's been two images when people think about nuclear power.
Scott Peterson is the Vice President for Communications at the Nuclear Energy Institute, the nuclear power lobby.
There's the image of electricity production, sort of the good image, and there's the image of nuclear weapons, obviously the bad image.
No! No! No!
One word answer. Incredible Hulk. Good for the industry, bad for the industry?
Bad.
Okay, elaborate on that.
One word answer. Anything that has a mutation involved in it, it's probably bad for the industry. If you ask people for an image of what used fuel might look like, people have a general impression that it's green ooze rather than it's a ceramic fuel pellet that is pretty benign in nature from a color standpoint. There's a lot of imagery out there that's simply not correct and is really a function of things like the Incredible Hulk or Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
So what would you like to come to mind when we think of nuclear power?
I would like it to be blue skies.
Journalist Karen Sharman says the nuclear power industry's claim that it produces no greenhouse gases is misleading. True, they don't pour out of smokestacks, but...
The production of that uranium fuel requires enormous amounts of electricity, most of that coal-fired electricity. About 10 years ago, the head of the U.S. Uranium Enrichment Corporation at Paducah, Kentucky, told me that the Paducah plant was the single largest user of electricity in the country.
As for safety, in March of 2002 at the Davis-Bessie nuclear power plant in Ohio, a delayed inspection found that erosion had eaten away 6.5 inches of the reactor pressure vessel head. It was apparently 60 days away from being a Three Mile Island-like incident. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission ranked it the fifth most dangerous incident since Three Mile Island. But studies of Three Mile Island have concluded that it was not nearly as grave as was believed at the time. True, some in the community claimed that they suffered radiation poisoning and higher rates of cancer. Some settled out of court. But the terms of those settlements are secret. Karen Sharman.
I think if we're talking about something as potentially dangerous as nuclear power, these incidents need to be part of the national conversation, and they're not.
Fact is, these days the conversation about nuclear power is pretty upbeat. Scott Peterson.
In the last couple of months alone, there have been cover stories in Fortune, in The Economist, in The Washington Post, and in many other newspapers. And from the research we've conducted, we know that the more people read or see information about nuclear energy in the media, the more favorable they become.
The Nuclear Energy Institute offers tours of power plants to legislators and journalists. It works with groups like the National Science Teachers Association to develop classroom materials. They've even created a Boy Scout nuclear merit badge. Polls suggest that public support for nuclear energy just keeps growing. It already supplies 20% of America's electricity and an even higher percentage of Japan's. If any nation should be leery of nuclear technology, it's that one. And 80% of France's power is nuclear. Stephen Dubner.
The bottom line is that nuclear energy is far, far, far less dangerous in practice, in aggregate, than the average American thought 30 years ago.
But Karen Sharman says, still, that shouldn't end the conversation.
There's a comment by the Bush administration's point man on nuclear power, the Deputy Secretary of Energy, Clay Sell, who says, quote,
"No serious person can look at the challenge of greenhouse gases and climate change and not come to the conclusion that nuclear power has to play a significant and growing role in meeting that challenge worldwide."
Karen Sharman says that statement dismisses serious critics of nuclear power, and she hears it so often she's convinced it's an industry talking point.
If we're serious about environmental protection, then we must seriously question the wisdom of backing
away. You can't be serious about reducing the effect of greenhouse gases.
We must be serious about expanding our nuclear power generating capacity.
Dubner says it's neither public relations nor a compliant press nor national amnesia that has weakened our opposition to nuclear power. It is fear of the incalculable risk of global warming. Fear expressed on magazine covers and in such films as An Inconvenient Truth and The Day After Tomorrow. We prefer the devil we know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Power, to the devil we don't.
That's essentially my point, which is that this thing that was feared because it was risky is now feared less because there's a new risk, global warming, that is not only risky, but the risk is uncertain. And uncertainty is scarier than a certain kind of risk.
That is, as long as you don't rent The China Syndrome. We just did, and believe me, that movie is scary as hell.
Gotta think. Okay, somewhere there's a thingy that tells you how to work this stuff. Don't! Who'd have thought a nuclear reactor would be so complicated?
Back in January, NPR senior correspondent Juan Williams scored a major get, a one-on-one interview with President Bush. These sit-downs are not easy to come by, especially for NPR, which alone among major broadcast networks has not secured a presidential interview for any program host in Bush's 6.5 years in office. But if anyone in the White House press office fretted about exposing the president to the leftist rantings of Radio Moscow, they needn't have been concerned.
You asked the Democrats on a bipartisan basis to form an advisory council and monitor the war, work with you. They haven't responded at all. What do you take from that? You know, people are praying for you. People, the American people, want to be with you, Mr. President. But you just spoke about... Mr. President, you've talked about Harry Truman and the challenges that President Truman faced during his time here. He wasn't popular toward the end of his presidency, but history ended up judging him very well. Is that your hope now? Mr. President, I want to say thank you from National Public Radio.
Juan, thank you, buddy. Glad you're here.
I appreciate it,
yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Last week, the White House offered up the president to NPR once again to discuss the 50th anniversary of school desegregation and once again reached out to Juan Williams. But this time, NPR said no thanks. Joining me now is Ellen Weiss, the network's vice president for news. Ellen, first time on OTM. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Why did you pass?
We passed because after the January interview, we thanked the White House and we told them that our future requests were for an interview with NPR. Previous to that, we had asked lots of different people to put in requests for interviews. We had asked Juan, we had asked all the programs, we had asked our White House correspondents. And the fact of the matter is the White House was fielding several different requests from NPR and picked one of those requests. And we recognized that that was not how we wanted to proceed. We wanted the White House to grant NPR an interview and for NPR to decide who would do that interview, which is similar to how we've been treated by previous administrations.
Now, this situation isn't exactly unique. A couple of weeks ago, Hillary Clinton offered to speak about health insurance with reporter Julie Rovner, and you declined that one as well. The principle, I guess, being not to be manipulated by the news source. Is that correct?
Well, the principle being that we have had a request in for Mrs. Clinton for several months now, and while we were, of course, interested in talking to her health care plans, we wanted to make sure that we talked to her about a wide variety of issues. And in that case, the Clinton campaign agreed, and Melissa Block, the host, one of the hosts of All Things Considered, did the interview. And the interview not only included questions about health care, but about campaign fundraising and about Iraq.
So how much of the decision this time stemmed from that principle, and how much from the criticism the first time around with Juan and the president, that he snagged this rare interview only to serve up a series of softballs?
You know, it stemmed entirely from the principal. As soon as we concluded the interview in January, we had a conversation with the White House, which we made it quite clear to them that we had created the situation, in a sense, for them to decide who did the interview, because we had multiple requests in, and we didn't want to create any of that confusion anymore. We wanted to determine who did the interviews.
It seems to me that this is all complicated by the fact that Juan also works as an analyst on the GOP House organ known as the Fox News Channel, which, by the way, along with Williams himself, criticized your news judgment in declining this presidential interview. Do you see a conflict of interest developing here?
You know, I think, understandably, you know, Juan was disappointed. This is not about Juan. This is about journalistic integrity and journalistic independence.
All right. Ellen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Bob.
Ellen Weiss is Vice President for News at NPR.
On September 14th, Taro Aso, Japan's former Minister of Foreign Affairs, announced his candidacy for Prime Minister. This week, he lost. And though he wasn't expected to win, he did have one unique plank in his platform, an intention to use Japanese comics called manga as a tool of cultural diplomacy. Manga makes use of simple lines and no shading to create diversions ranging from romances to fairy tales to hardcore porn. Here in the States, it swept the publishing world and spawned entertainments ranging from Hollywood movies to the Food Channel's Iron Chef. Roland Keltz is a professor at the University of Tokyo. He says that Taro Aso understands manga's potential to raise Japan's global profile.
What he's on to is the fact that in terms of the popular consciousness, China and to some extent India are rising in the East, in Asia. And Japan is losing its grip on the world's imagination. And he wants to promote these popular arts as a way of retaining Japan's power, I suppose, and imagery in the world.
So it's sort of Japan's Hollywood.
You know, that's exactly right. It's Japan's Hollywood, although the creations themselves are far more diverse than what you generally get out of Hollywood today, which is one of the problems, because some of the stuff that is included under the very wide umbrella of manga and anime is racy or seedy or violent.
For those who may not have encountered it, and I know there are fewer and fewer of those, let's talk about manga here and there. I was in Barnes & Noble. I was with somebody quite young, and I said, what is this stuff? There's a whole wall of it. Describe it in one sentence. And she said, it's girls in miniskirts kicking people.
That's great. That's great. So, you know, some of it definitely is girls in miniskirts kicking and punching on their way to world domination. I think one possible analogy would be to compare it to the appeal of punk music upon a certain generation of teenagers, or hip-hop upon a later generation. And manga sales really took off in the U.S. and in Europe in the start of this century, when the importers and publishers overseas started to actually print it the way it reads here in Japan, which is from right to left. When they made that switch, they suddenly acquired a whole new cadre of fans who seemed to approve of the fact that this was not the way their parents read books.
Well, let's get down to a nitty-gritty definition of manga, because now that there is a genre for boys and girls and middle-aged businessmen and older women and for cooking and recipes and how to pay your taxes, how would you define something that ranges across so many audiences and so many topics?
Well, you're quite right that it's a protean art form. Historically speaking, the word can be traced back to the great woodblock print artist of the 19th century. His name was Hokusai. He coined the term to basically mean throwaway pictures. But the form that we know today was developed by a great artist named Osamu Tezuka, who in the 1950s created a hero that some Americans are familiar with now named Astro Boy.
I remember him well.
Yeah, do you? Well, Tezuka was working out of the ashes of World War II in Japan. So his version of manga contained a lot of the trauma and feelings of terror and resentment and vengeance in some way that existed in Japan after having been destroyed, really, by two atomic bombs. And that art form is really what we're talking about when we talk about manga today. And that art form then became almost an underground form of expression in Japan. It could say anything. It could say what you couldn't say in movies or TV.
Why do you think that so many anime characters don't have mouths?
Oh, yeah. I interviewed a very knowledgeable editor of one of Japan's biggest anime manga magazines. And he advised me to note that in manga, frequently realistic elements of the human body are left out. For example, there's not much emphasis on the ears or the nostrils, because he said your imagination doesn't need the ears or the nostrils. We fill these things in on our own. When I interviewed the people who created Hello Kitty, I said, why no mouth? And they said, because when you look at Hello Kitty, she should feel like you do. If you're in a great mood, she feels great, and your mind will project the emotions onto that face without the mouth telling you how to feel.
You say that it springs from a sort of underground sensibility, but can manga be cool if every salaryman is reading them on the train at night on their way home?
Salarymen and businesswomen are now reading manga in different forms, the most popular of which is the Japanese cell phone. And part of the reason is that if you're reading something that's a little bit unsavory, you can do so with much greater privacy if you're holding a cell phone screen up to your face. So manga is, in a sense, mainstream, but they're not acknowledged purchases.
You mean they're guilty pleasures?
Guilty pleasures, very much so, and private guilty pleasures in a lot of ways.
And yet you said that Asso and others within the government have coined the term manga diplomacy. That's public.
It's very public. And, you know, I just had lunch last week with an official from the government who has been working on this very project. And, you know, he emphasized to me that the importance of selecting the titles they actually choose to promote. So they're very aware of the fact that if manga diplomacy is going to be a popular art form that represents Japan, they don't want the girls kicking in their miniskirts to have miniskirts that are too short.
Roland, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Roland Keltz is the author of Japan America, How Japanese Pop Culture Has Invaded the U.S.
Coming up, pop culture obsesses over a war that ended 60 years ago, and Brooklyn still hurts after being abandoned 50 years ago.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Here are just a few of the movies now in or coming soon to a theater near you. In the Valley of Elah, Redacted, Rendition, Lion for Lambs, Grace is Gone, all generally related to Iraq or the War on Terror, movies that depict the war even as it's being waged. The war in Iraq has often been likened to the war in Vietnam, but Hollywood's quick reaction time is more like a replay of World War II. And as WNYC's Sarah Fishko reports, right now, pop culture is almost as obsessed with that war as it is with the current one.
December 7th, 1941, our land of freedom was defined.
After Pearl Harbor was attacked on December 7th, 1941, it took the music business all of 3 days to package, publish, and record this song.
We did it before, and we can do it again.
First airing on radio, December 10th of that year. So someone alive at that time heard news reports of the tragic events.
We interrupt this broadcast and bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
And then Roosevelt's speech on December 8th.
No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
And then, along with boys going off to war, the culture of the war started to emerge.
How it happened and how we remember it kind of come together. And popular memory is cultural memory.
Philip Beidler's book, The Good War's Greatest Hits, is subtitled World War II and American Remembering. It's about history and memory.
I think those things always combine. They always come to us through popular culture images, you know.
What do we recall and understand about that era? Beidler believes it was that war that could effectively be called the first media war. It was instantly surrounded, sold, and transformed by cultural expressions of every variety.
You have all these different mass communication media feeding off each other and offering something different.
Thomas Dougherty of Brandeis University is the author of Projections of War, Hollywood, American Culture, and World War II.
So life, of course, gives you the marvelous full-page pictures that you can examine. Radio gives you the oral immediacy of it. People like Edward R. Murrow would take you up in a B-17 over Germany during a bombardment.
The sky ahead was lit up by bright yellow flares. Off to starboard, another kite went down in flames. The flares were sprouting all over the sky, reds and greens and yellows. And we were flying straight for the center of the fireworks.
Newsreels, of course.
And the president's words meant action.
The first of them appeared less than a week after the Pearl Harbor attack. But the dramatic feature films about the war were a genre in themselves.
During World War II, we don't know we're going to win the war. So those movies are actually, you know, much more severe, mature than some of the movies made afterwards. They really want to give Americans harsh lessons about the nature of heroism, the sheer terror of the enemy, and the power of the enemy.
One of those was Air Force, the 1943 film about a B-17 bomber, the crew all working together to accomplish a dangerous mission. It was a message picture, like many of the era.
Now look, Wanaki, there are two other men on this ship who washed out as pilots.
The message of these films is that no one individual is more important than another individual.
We need you, just like we need the whole gang. It takes all of us to make this ship function.
In Air Force, the hero is the combat squad.
Every man has got to rely on every other man to do the right thing at the right time. You played football, Wanaki. You know how one man can gum up the whole works.
Part of the message of these films also was that of a tolerant America, unified against its enemy. The idea of the harmonious melting pot, whether it was true or not.
There's only one city in the USA, and that's New York.
Oh, you're just another hometown hick, Weinberg. What's wrong with California?
You have these sort of statistically apportioned ethnic groups that, you know, happen to be on every plane or any combat squad, and you got the, you know, the Brooklyn Jew, the, you know, the Boston Irishman, you know, the Iowa farm boy, the guy named Tex, and all these different American ethnicities and regions, all, of course, working together to defeat the Nazi enemy.
Minneapolis? Why, the grass still grows in the streets. Besides that,
America's melting pot image was a useful and necessary way of putting off our own issues in a time of war. And in some ways, the popular culture was way ahead of the reality. You could almost say the propaganda charted a course for America.
At the end of the war, you can't go back, right? You can't go back to a culture that's a Jim Crow culture or a culture that doesn't embrace different ethnicities and sensibilities. So right after the Second World War, not coincidentally, Jackie Robinson in 1947 enters Major League Baseball, Truman integrates the armed forces in 48, Hollywood begins making its first, really unapologetic social problem films about American racism.
The Academy Award for Best Picture of 1947 went to Gentlemen's Agreement, the film about American anti-Semitism.
They call me a dirty Jew, and a thing is
all this stuff sort of just spews out in American culture and American cinema.
So memory, history, popular culture, and experience all shift and trade places over time to create a certain kind of recollection.
Real things happen, and part of reality is that they get assimilated, you know, into our lives, made sense of, and passed down.
Professor James Young writes about history and memory in books like At Memory's Edge and The Texture of Memory. Growing up, his favorite post-war TV show was the series Combat.
Everything that happened in that war, from the TV programs, the popular, you know, cultural, you know, representations of it, the books I read, the stories I heard, really did shape all of our lives, through the 60s especially. So we were somehow thinking of war all the time, a big war, even a third world war. And that did shape us for better or worse.
For a long time, the World War II myth held strong. America as the noble face for good democratic values that must be fought for.
And then the Vietnam ethos, which is that there are times in which America is the villain in foreign affairs and that it can get involved in meaningless wars that send back nothing but body bags. And those tend to be the two different dynamics that America now faces whenever it's confronted with another foreign policy adventure.
Now, as then, with our war in progress, the media are sending out uncompromising messages about the ugly business of fighting a war. What they've not provided so far is the uplifting patriotic narrative that so enshrined the Second World War, the first media war, in our memories. For On the Media, I'm Sarah Fischko.
This week marked the 50th anniversary of the very last game played by the Brooklyn Dodgers, Dem Bums, as they were affectionately known, at Ebbets Field. The Dodgers shut out the Pittsburgh Pirates 2-0 to finish third in the National League, capping off a 45-year stretch at the ballpark that included some of the most thrilling moments in baseball history. Among them, a 10th-inning RBI by Jackie Robinson to win Game 6 of the 1956 World Series against their Bronx rivals, the New York Yankees.
Robinson waits. Here comes the pitch. And there goes a line drive to left field. Swann is after it. He leaps. It's over his head against the wall. Here comes Gilliam scoring. Brooklyn wins. Jackie Robinson is being pummeled by his teammates.
By the spring of 1958, the boys of Brooklyn had packed up and headed west for Los Angeles in search of open spaces and a better stadium, leaving Brooklyn fans without a team. And to this day, the pain lingers. Michael Shapiro is author of The Last Good Season, Brooklyn, the Dodgers, and Their Final Pennant Race Together. Shapiro says that Brooklynites of the time lost far more than a ball club.
In a word, Brooklyn lost its conversation. Baseball has the advantage, unlike any other sport, of literally having a game every day. And so what you have as a result of that is a daily conversation between strangers. The person you run into in the elevator, the person waiting online at the deli or the dry cleaner, the person waiting for the bus. Conversation that begins and ends with something along the lines of, did you see what they did last night? Do you believe that Snyder? Do you believe that Reese? Did you see how they came back? Whatever it was, with no need to take it any further. And when the Dodgers left, all of a sudden Brooklyn was left without something to talk about. And that longing, in many ways, never went away.
I want to play you this clip. It is of Ralph Branca, the pitcher who famously or infamously served up the home run to Bobby Thompson, with which the New York Giants won the 1951 pennant from the Dodgers.
Let me alone. Go ahead, let me alone. Let me be, will you? You saw what happened. Things are tough enough. Yeah, I knew it was gone all the way. All I kept saying was, sink, sink, sink. All I remember is seeing Paff go up against the wall, and then I was walking to the clubhouse. All I kept saying was, why me, why me? Why did he have to be me?
There is no wall that exists between those fans and Ralph Branca. He is accessible. He is heartbroken. He wants to be left alone, but he's there. And the fact is that that wall that so much exists as part of sports journalism today simply didn't exist back then. Sports writers traveled with the players. They played cards with the players. They drank with the players. As a result of that, those players were brought into the lives of their fans. Now, one could argue, and I think very fairly, that the relationship that existed was pretty chummy. They didn't write about the womanizing. They didn't write about the drinking. There was a certain agreement and understanding of what was permissible and what wasn't that permitted precisely what you're hearing on that tape, which is a man giving a range of emotion from leave me alone to this is what happened. And we don't hear that kind of thing quite the same way today.
It seems to me there's something about the Dodgers leaving Brooklyn that looms large in the wider culture. I mean, the New York Giants fled the Polo Grounds for San Francisco actually before the Dodgers left Brooklyn, and the Senators left Washington, and the Athletics left Philadelphia. Why is the Dodgers' flight to L.A. deemed so quintessential?
The Dodgers really represent in many ways, forgive me, the grand harmonic conversions of fandom. Between 1947 and 1957, two things happen. One, the Dodgers are the second-best team in baseball, the best team in the National League, second only to the Yankees, the team on the other side of the river. And also the Dodgers remember, and one can never minimize this, they were the first integrated team. And the Dodgers began to gather a following that existed far beyond the borders of Brooklyn. And the Brooklyn Dodgers, especially if you were a black person, were synonymous with Jackie Robinson and later Roy Campanella and Don Newcomb. So the Dodgers took on a meaning far beyond baseball themselves. And they finally win once. They win the World Series. They beat the Yankees in 1955. They weren't haughty like the Yankees. They didn't live in New Jersey like the Yankees. They lived in Brooklyn. They were our guys. And then they were gone, like ghosts.
All right, Michael. Thank you so much.
And thank you.
Michael Shapiro is a professor at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism and author of a number of books, including The Last Good Season, Brooklyn, The Dodgers, and Their Final Pennant Race Together. Imagine you're a 10-year-old kid growing up in New York and your beloved Brooklyn Dodgers skip town. Washington Post sports writer Len Shapiro doesn't have to imagine it. He lived it.
That was heartbreaking. I patterned my batting stance after Roy Campanella. I idolized Duke Snyder, Pee Wee Reese, all those guys. And they took it away. And I couldn't figure out why. I mean, they got great coverage. The fans were boisterous. They won a lot of games. They never won the big one up until 1955 when I was 8 years old, which was, by the way, one of the greatest moments of my life. But to have that taken away from you and all you have left really are the hated New York Yankees for a long time, it was gut-wrenching, really gut-wrenching, and it was not a good time for kids who followed baseball in New York.
Did you root for the Los Angeles Dodgers?
I absolutely did not root for the Los Angeles Dodgers. I only rooted for the players I knew who went there. And quite frankly, Bob, I've been a sports writer for the Washington Post since 1969. I have never seen the Dodgers play again. The last game I saw was at Ebbets Field when I was probably 9 years old. I just didn't think I could make it through it without thinking about what those guys did to us.
Len Shapiro is a sports reporter and columnist at the Washington Post. He had his Dodgers wrested away from him. Neil Sullivan had them dropped into his lap. Sullivan, a professor at the Baruch College School of Public Affairs and author of The Dodgers Move West, was 10 years old and living in L.A. when the Dodgers miraculously appeared.
One of the great days of childhood. It was April 18th, 1958. My dad came by to get me at school. This was St. Augustine's in Culver City. It must have been about 10 o'clock. And we're driving across the playground when my dad noticed there was a priest coming back from a morning mass. My dad said, this was a Friday, he said, go over there and get us a dispensation so we can have hot dogs at the game.
Instead of fish on Friday.
Exactly. Well, the priest made some review of canon law in his head and looked down and said, well, I think if you're getting out of school, that's quite enough for one day. So I went back to the car, jumped in and told my dad, the car starts moving forward slowly. My father, who was very much a gentleman of the old school, rolls down his window, comes to a stop near the priest, and says, anybody who wouldn't let a little kid have a hot dog at the ballpark is a jerk. And rolled the window up. I was horrified. This was at least sacrilege. It was at least a venial sin. I was terrified for the man's soul. So jumped in. Dad, he's a priest. Window rolls back down again. My father looks at him and says, father jerk. The window goes back up.
How was the game?
It was a great game. The Dodgers beat the Giants. You could not improve on things. It was wonderful.
By the time this show airs, the National League East race will most likely have been decided between the Mets and the Phillies. I am a diehard Phillies fan. Will you not join me in praying for a favorable outcome?
No, you would only do that for the Dodgers. You don't pray for some other team. That's just...
All right, I've clearly asked too much. Neil, thank you very much.
You're entirely welcome. It was my pleasure.
Neil Sullivan is a professor at Baruch College School of Public Affairs. He is the author of The Dodgers Move West.
Satchel Paige is mellow, so is Campanella, Newcomb and Dobie too. But it's a natural fact, when Jackie comes to bat, the other team is through.
Did you see Jackie Robinson hit that ball? Did he hit it? Yes, and that ain't all. He's no more.
Yes, yes, Jackie's real gone.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer, our webmaster, is Amy Pearl.
We had help from Andy Lancet, Kara McCormick, Jessica Magaldi, Ian Whitehead, and Wayne Schumeister. Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Yes, yes, Jack is real God. Jackie is a real God guy.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.